had had, which was a hole in his belly that wouldn't quite heal shut. Someone had shot Lippy with a big bore gun. Instead of dying, he ended up living with a leak. With a handicap like that, it was lucky he could play the piano. Augustus got up and stretched. He took his coat and holster off the back of the chair. So far as he was concerned, the night was young. He had to step over the shote to get off the porch.
"You oughtn't to be so stubborn about that boy, Woodrow. He spent about enough of his life shoveling horse shit. Well, I'm a sight older than him, and I still shovel my share of it," Carl said. "Well, that's your choice. It's my view that there are more fragrant ways to make a fortune. Card playing for one. Now I believe I'll straggle down to that gin palace and see if I can scare up a game."
Carl was about finished with his smoke.
"I don't mind your card playing if that's all it is," he said.
Augustus grinned. Carl never changed.
"What else would it be?" "You never used to gamble this regular," Carl said. "You better watch that girl." "Watch her for what?"
"To see she don't get you to marry her," Carl said. "You're just enough of an old fool to do it. I won't have that girl around." Augustus had a good laugh. Carl was given to some funny notions, but that was one of the funniest. To think that a man of his years and experience would marry a whore.
"See you at breakfast."
Carl sat on the steps a little while longer, listening to the blue pig snore.
Chapter 3
Lorena had never lived in a place where it was cool. It was her one aim. It seemed to her that she had learned to sweat at the same time she had learned to breathe, and she was still doing both. Of all the places she had heard men talk about, San Francisco sounded the coolest, nicest. So it was San Francisco she set her sights on. Sometimes it seemed like slow going. She was nearly 24 and hadn't gotten a mile past Lonesome Dove, which wasn't fast progress considering she had only been 12 when her parents got nervous about Yankees and left Mobile. That much slow progress would have discouraged most women, but Lorena didn't allow her mind to dwell on it. She had her flat days, of course, but that was mostly because Lonesome Dove itself was so flat. She got tired of looking out the window all day and seeing nothing but brown land and gray chaparral. In the middle of the day, the sun was so hot, the land looked white. She could see the river from her window in Mexico. Lippy told her she could make a fortune if she cared to establish herself in Mexico, but Lorena didn't care to. From what she could see of the country, it didn't look any more interesting than Texas, and the men stunk just as bad as Texans, if not worse. Gus McCrae claimed to have been to San Francisco and would talk to her for hours about how blue the water was in the bay and how the ships came in from everywhere. In the end, he overtalked it, like he did everything. Once or twice, Lorena felt she had a clear picture of it, listening to Gus, but by the time he finally quit talking, she would have lost it and just be lying there, wishing it would cool off. In that respect, Gus was unusual, for most men didn't talk. He would blab right up until the time he shoved his old carrot in. Then he would be blabbing again before it was even dry. Generous as he was by local standards, he gave her $5 in gold every single time. Lorena still felt a little underpaid. It should have been $5 for wetting his carrot and another $5 for listening to him blab. Some of it was interesting, but Lorena couldn't keep her mind on so much talk. It didn't seem to hurt Gus's feelings any. He talked just as cheerful whether she was listening or not, and he never tried to talk her into giving him two pokes for the price of one, as most of the younger men did. It was peculiar that he was her most regular customer, because he was also her oldest. She made a point of not letting anything men did surprise her much, but secretly it did surprise her a little that a man as old as Gus would still be so partial to it. In that respect, he put a lot of younger men to shame, including Mosby Marlin, who had held her up for 2 years over in East Texas. Compared to Gus, Mosby couldn't even be said to have a carrot, though he did have kind of a little stringy radish that he was far too proud of. She had only been 17 when she met Mosby, and both her parents were dead. Her pa fell out in Vicksburg, and her ma only made it to Baton Rouge. So it was Baton Rouge where she was stranded when Mosby found her. She hadn't done any sporting up to that time, though she had developed early and had even had some trouble with her own paw, though he was feverish to the point of delirium when the trouble happened. He died soon after. She knew Mosby was a drunkard from the first, but he told her that he was a southern gentleman and he had an expensive buggy and a fine pair of horses, so she believed him. Mosby claimed that he wanted to marry her, and Lorena believed that too, and let him drag her off to a big old drafty house near a place called Gladewater. The house was huge, but it didn't even have glass in the windows, or rugs, or anything. They had to set smoke pots in the rooms to keep the mosquitoes from eating them alive, which the mosquitoes did anyway. Mosby had a mother and two mean sisters and no money, and no intention of marrying Lorena anyway, though he kept claiming he would for a while. In fact, the women folk treated Lorena worse than they treated the niggers, and they didn't treat the niggers good. They didn't treat Mosby good either, or one another good. About the only creatures that ever saw any kindness around the house were Mosby's hounds. Mosby assured her that he'd set the hounds on her if she ever tried to run away. It was in the nights when Lorena had to lay there with the smoke from the pots so thick that she couldn't breathe and the clouds of mosquitoes nearly as thick as the smoke, and Mosby constantly bothering her with his radish, that Lorena's spirit sunk so low she ceased to want to talk. She became a silent woman. Soon after, the sporting started, because Mosby lost so much money one night that he offered two of his friends poke in exchange for his debt. Lorena was so surprised that she didn't have time to arm herself, and the men had their way. But the next morning, when the two were gone, she went at Mosby with his own quirt and cut his face so badly they put her in the cellar for 2 days and didn't even bring her food. 2 or 3 months later, it happened again with some more friends, and this time Lorena didn't fight. She was just so tired of Mosby and his radish and the smoke pots that she was willing to consider anything different. The mother and the mean sisters wanted to drive her out of the house, and Lorena would have been glad to go, but Mosby threw such a fit that one of the sisters ran off herself to live with an aunt. Then one night, Mosby just plain sold a poke to a traveling man of some kind. He seemed to be planning to do it regular, only the second man he sold her to happened to take a fancy to Lorena. His name was John Tinkersley, the tallest and prettiest man Lorena had seen up to that point, and the cleanest. When he asked her if she was really married to Mosby, she said no. Tinkersley suggested then and there that she accompany him to San Antonio. Lorena was glad to agree. Mosby was so shocked by her decision that he offered to get the preacher and marry her on the spot. And by that time, Lorena had figured out that being married to Mosby would be even worse than what she had already been through. Mosby tried for a while to work himself up to a fight, but he was no match for Tinkersley, and he knew it. The best he could salvage was to sell Tinkersley a horse for Lorena, plus the side saddle that belonged to the sister who'd run off. San Antonio was a big improvement over Gladewater, if only because there were no smoke pots and few mosquitoes. They kept 2 rooms in a hotel, not the finest in town, but fine enough, and Tinkersley bought Lorena some pretty clothes. Of course, he financed that by selling the horse and the side saddle, which disappointed Lorena a little. She had discovered that she liked riding. She would have been happy to ride on to San Francisco, but Tinkersley had no interest in that. Clean and tall and pretty as he was, he turned out, in the end, to be no better bargain than Mosby. If he had a soft spot, it was for himself, and not for her. He even spent money getting his fingernails cut, which was something Lorena had never dreamed a man would do. For all that, he was a hard man. Fighting with Mosby had been like fighting with a little boy, whereas the first time she talked back to Tinkersley, he hit her so hard her head cracked a washpot on the bureau behind her. Her ears rang for 3 days. He threatened to do worse than that, too, and Lorena didn't suppose that they were idle threats. She held her tongue around Tinkersley from then on. He made it clear that marriage wasn't what he had had in mind when he took her away from Mosby, which was all right in itself, since she had already got out of the habit of thinking about marriage. That didn't mean that she was in the habit of thinking about herself as a sporting woman, but it was precisely that habit that Tinkersley expected her to acquire. "Well, you're already trained, ain't you?" he said. Lorena didn't consider what had happened in Gladewater any training for anything. But then it was clear there wasn't anything respectable she was trained for, even if she could get away from Tinkersley without being killed. For a few days she had thought Tinkersley might love her, but he soon made it clear that she meant about as much to him as a good saddle. She knew that for the time being the sporting life was about her only choice. At least the hotel room was nice, and there were no mean sisters. Most of the sports who came to see her were men Tinkersley gambled with in the bar down below. Once in a while, a nice one would even give her a little money directly, instead of leaving it with Tinkersley. But Tinkersley was smart about such things, and he found her hiding place and cleaned her out the day they took the stage to Matamoros. He might not have done it if he hadn't had a string of losses, but the fact that he was handsome didn't mean that he was a good gambler, as several of the sports pointed out to Lorena. He was just a middling gambler, and he had such a run of bad luck in San Antonio that he decided there might be less competition down on the border. It was on that trip that they had the real fight. Lorena felt swollen with anger about the money, swollen enough, finally, not to be scared of him. What she wanted was to kill him for being so determined to leave her absolutely nothing. If she had known more about guns, she would have killed him. She thought with a gun you just pulled the trigger, but it turned out his had to be cocked first. Tinkersley was laying on the bed drunk, but not so drunk he didn't notice when she stuck his own gun in his stomach. When she realized it wasn't going to go off, she had just time to hit him in the face with it. A lick that actually won the fight for her. Although before he gave up and went to look for a doctor to stitch his jaw up, Tinkersley did bite her on the upper lip as they were rolling around, Lorena still hoping the gun would shoot. The bite had left a faint little scar just above her upper lip. To Lorena's amusement, it was that trifling scar that seemed to make men crazy for a time with her. Of course, it wasn't just the scar. She had developed well and had also gotten prettier as she got older, but the scar played its part. Tinkersley got drunk in Lonesome Dove the day he left her, and he told everyone in the dry bean that she was a murderous woman. So she had a reputation in the town before she even unpacked her clothes. Tinkersley had left her with no money at all, but fortunately she could cook when she had to. The dry bean was the only place in Lonesome Dove that served food, and Lorena had been able to talk Xavier Wants, who owned it, into letting her do the cooking until the cowboys got over being scared of her and began to approach her. Augustus was the man who got it started. While he was pulling off his boots the first time, he smiled at her. "Where'd you get that scar?" he asked. "Somebody bit me," Lorena said. Once Gus became a regular, she had no trouble making a living in town, although in the summer, when the cowboys were mostly off on the trail, picking sometimes grew slim. While she was well past the point of trusting men, she soon perceived that Gus was in a class by himself, at least in Lonesome Dove. He wasn't mean, and he didn't treat her like most men treated a sporting woman. She knew he would probably even help her if she really needed it. It seemed to her that he had got rid of something other men hadn't gotten rid of, some meanness or some need. He was the one man, besides Lippy, she would sometimes talk to, a little. With most of the sports, she had nothing to say at all. In fact, her silence soon came to be widely commented on. It was part of her, like the scar. And, like the scar, it drew men to her even though it made them deeply uneasy. It was not a trick, either, although she knew it unnerved the sports and made matters go quicker. Silent happened to be how she felt when the men were with her. In respect to her silence, too, Gus McCrae was different. At first he seemed not to notice it. Certainly he didn't let it bother him. Then it began to amuse him. Which was not a reaction Lorena had had from anyone else. Most men chattered like squirrels when they were with her, no doubt hoping she would say something back. Of course, Gus was a great blabber, but his blabbing wasn't really like the chattering the other sports did. He was just full of opinion, which he freely poured out, as much for his own amusement as for anything. Lorena had never particularly looked at life as if it was something funny, but Gus did. Even her lack of talk struck him as funny. One day he walked in and sat down in a chair. the usual look of amusement on his face. Lorena assumed he was going to take his boots off, and she went over to the bed. But when she looked around, he was sitting there, one foot on the other knee, twirling the rowel of a spur. He always wore spurs, although it was not often she saw him on horseback. Once in a while in the early morning, bawling of cattle or the nickering of horses would awaken her, and she would look out the window and see him and his partners and a gang of riders trailing their stock through the low brush to the east of town. Gus was noticeable, since he rode a big black horse that looked like it could have pulled three stagecoaches by itself. But he kept his spurs on even when he wasn't riding, so he would have them handy when he wanted something to jingle. "Now, them's the only musical instruments I ever learned to play," he told her once, since he just sat there twirling his spur and smiling at her. Lorena didn't know whether to get undressed or what. It was July, blistering hot. She had tried sprinkling the bed sheets, but the heat dried them sometimes before she could even lay down.
"Ah, God, it's hot. We could all be living in Canada just as cheap. I doubt I've even got the energy to set my post."
Why come, then? Lorena thought. Another unusual thing about Gus was that he could practically tell what she was thinking. In this case, he looked abashed and dug a $10 gold piece out of his pocket, which he pitched over to her. Lorena felt wary. It was $5 too much, even if he did decide to set his post. She knew old men got crazy sometimes and wanted strange things. Lippy was a constant problem, and he had a hole in his stomach and could barely keep up his piano playing, but it turned out she had no need to worry about Gus.
"I figured out something, Lori. I figured out why you and me get along so well. You know more than you say, and I say more than I know. That means we're a perfect match, as long as we don't hang around one another more than an hour at a stretch."
It made no sense to Lorena, but she relaxed. There was no likelihood he would try anything crazy on her. "This is $10, she said, thinking maybe he just hadn't noticed what kind of money he was handing over.
"You know, prices are funny. I've known a good many sporting girls, and I've always wondered why they didn't price more flexible. If I was in your place and had to traipse upstairs with some of these old smelly sorts, I'd want a sight of money. Whereas, if it was some good-looking young sprout who kept himself barbered up, why, a nickel might be enough."
Lorena remembered Tinkersley, who had had the use of her for 2 years, taken all she brought in, and then left her without a cent. "A nickel wouldn't be enough," she said. "I can do without the barbering." But Augustus was in the mood for discussion.
"Well, say you put $2 as your low figure. Now, that's for the well-barbered sprout. Now, what would the high figure be for some big, rank waddy who couldn't even spell? Now, the point I'm making is that all men ain't the same, so they shouldn't be at the same price. Or am I wrong? Now, maybe from where you sit, all men are the same."
Once she thought about it, Lorena saw his point. All men weren't quite the same. A few were nice enough that she might notice them, and a goodly few were mean enough that she couldn't help noticing them, but the majority were neither one nor the other. They were just men, and they left money, not memories. So far, it was only the mean ones who had left memories. "Why'd you give me this 10?" she asked, willing to be a little curious since it seemed it was going to be just talk anyway.
"Hoping to get you to talk a minute," Augustus said, smiling.
He had the most white hair she had ever seen on a man. He mentioned once that it turned white when he was 30, making his life more dangerous since the Indians would have considered a white scalp a prize.
"I was married twice, you remember. Should have been married a third time, but the woman made a mistake and didn't marry me."
"What's that got to do with this money?" Lorena asked.
"The point is, I ain't a natural bachelor," Augustus said. "There's days when a little bit of talk with a female is worth any price. I figure the reason you don't have much to say is you probably never met a man who liked to hear a woman talk. Now, listening to a woman ain't the fashion in this part of the country, But I expect that you got a life story like everybody else. And if you'd like to tell it, I'm the one that'd like to hear it. Lorena thought that over. Gus didn't seem uncomfortable. He just sat there twirling his rowl. And these parts, what your business is all about, is woman's company anyway, he said. Now, in a cold climb, it might be different. A cold climb will perk up a boy and make him want to wiggle his bean. But down here in this heat, it's mostly company thereafter.
There was something to that. Men looked at her sometimes like they wished that she would be their sweetheart, the young ones particularly, but some of the old ones, too. One or two had even wanted her to let them keep her, though where they meant to do the keeping she didn't know. She was already living in the only spare bedroom in Lonesome Dove. Little marriages were what they wanted, just something that would last until they started up the trail. Some girls did it that way. Hitched up with a cowboy for a month or 6 weeks and got presents and played at being respectable. She had known girls who did it that way in San Antonio. The thing that struck her was that the girl seemed to believe it as much as the cowboys did. They would act just as silly as respectable girls, getting jealous of one another and pouting all day if their boys didn't act to suit them. Lorena had no interest in conducting things that way. The men who came to see her would have to realize that she was not interested in play-acting. After a bit, she decided she wasn't interested in telling Augustus her life story, either. She buttoned her dress back up and handed him the $10. "It ain't worth $10," she said, "even if I could remember it all." Augustus stuck the money back in his pocket.
"I ought to know better than to try and buy a conversation," he said, still grinning. "Let's go on down and play some cards."
Chapter 4
When Augustus left Call sitting on the steps, he took a slow stroll through the wagon yard and down the street, stopping for a moment on the sandy bottom of Hat Creek to strap on his pistol. The night was quiet as sleep, no night when he expected to have to shoot anybody, but it was only wise to have the pistol handy in case he had to whack a drunk. It was an old Colt Dragoon with a 7-inch barrel, and he was fond of saying, weighed about as much as the leg he strapped it to. One whack would usually satisfy most drunks, and two whacks would drop an ox if Augustus cared to put his weight into it. The border knights had qualities that he had come to admire, different as they were from the qualities of knights in Tennessee. In Tennessee, as he remembered, knights tended to be mushy, with a cottony mist drifting into the hollows. Border knights were so dry you could smell the dirt, and clear as dew. In fact, the nights were so clear it was tricky. Even with hardly any moon, the stars were bright enough that every bush and fence post cast shadow. P.I., who had a jumpy disposition, was always shying from shadows, and he had even blazed away at innocent chaparral bushes on occasion, mistaking them for bandits. Augustus was not particularly nervous, but even so, he had hardly started down the street before he got a scare. A little ball of shadow ran right at his feet. He jumped sideways, fearing snake bite. Although his brain knew snakes didn't roll like balls, then he saw an armadillo hustle past his feet. Once he saw what it was, he tried to give it a kick to teach it not to walk in the street scaring people. But the armadillo hurried right along as if it had as much right to the street as a banker. The town was not roaring with people, nor was it bright with lights, though a light was on at the Pumphreys, whose daughter was about to have a baby. The Pumphreys ran a store. The baby their daughter was expecting would arrive in the world to find itself fatherless, since the boy who had married the Pumphrey girl had drowned in the Republican River in the fall of the year, with the girl only just pregnant. There was only one horse hitched outside the dry bean when Augustus strolled up. A rangy sorrel that he recognized as belonging to a cowboy named Dishwater Boget. So named because he had once rushed into camp so thirsty from a dry drive that he wouldn't wait his turn at the water barrel, and he had filled up on some dishwater the cook had been about to throw out. Seeing the sorrel gave Augustus a prime feeling because Dish Boget loved card playing, though he lacked even minimal skills. Of course, he also probably lacked anti-money, but that didn't necessarily rule out a game. Dish was a good hand and could always get hired. Augustus didn't mind playing for futures with such a man. When he stepped in the door, everybody was looking peeved, probably because Lippy was banging away at My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean, a song that he loved to excess and played as if he hoped it could be heard in the capital of Mexico. Xavier Watts, the little Frenchman who owned the place, was nervously wiping his tables with a wet rag. Xavier seemed to think keeping the tables well wiped was the crucial factor in his business, though Augustus was often forced to point out to him that such a view was nonsense. Most of the patrons of the Dry Bean were so lacking in fastidiousness that they wouldn't have noticed a dead skunk on the tables, much less a few crumbs and spilled drinks. Xavier himself had a near monopoly on fastidiousness in Lonesome Dove. He wore a white shirt the year round, clipped his little mustache once a week, and even wore a bow tie, or at least a black shoestring that did its best to serve as a bow tie. Some cowpoke had swiped Xavier's last real bow tie, probably meaning to try and impress some girl somewhere up the trail. Since the shoestring was limp and not stiff like a bow tie should be, it merely added to the melancholy of Xavier's appearance, which would have been melancholy enough without it. He had been born in New Orleans and had ended up in Lonesome Dove because someone had convinced him Texas was the land of opportunity. Though he soon discovered otherwise, he was too proud or too fatalistic to attempt to correct his mistake. He approached day-to-day life in the Dry Bean with a resigned temper, which on occasion stopped being resigned and became explosive. When it exploded, the placid air was apt to be rent by Creole curses. "Good evening, my good friend," Augustus said. He said it with as much gravity as he could muster, since Xavier appreciated a certain formality. It was hard to extend the amenities when Lippy was at the height of a performance. Dish Boget was sitting at one of the tables with Lorena, hoping to persuade her to give him a poke on credit. Though Dish was barely 22, he wore a walrus mustache that made him look years older than he was, and much more solemn. In color, the mustache was stuck between yellow and brown, kind of prairie dog colored, Augustus thought. He frequently suggested to Dish that if he wanted to eat prairie dog, he ought to remember to pick his teeth, a reference to the mustache whose subtlety was lost on Dish. Lorena had her usual look, the look of a woman who was somewhere else. She had a fine head of blonde hair, whose softness alone set her apart in a country where most women's hair had a consistency not much softer than saddle strings. Her cheeks hollowed a little, but gave her a distracting beauty. Augustus's experience had taught him that hollow-cheeked beauty was a dangerous kind. His two wives had both been fat-cheeked and trustworthy, but had possessed little resistance to the climate. One had expired of pleurisy in only the second year of their marriage, while the other had been carried off by scarlet fever after the seventh. But the woman Lorena put him most in mind of was Clara Allen, whom he had loved hardest and deepest, and still loved. Clara's eyes were direct and sparkled with interest, whereas Lorena's were always side-looking. Still, there was something about the girl that reminded him of Clara, who had chosen a stolid horse rancher when she decided to marry. "I got Dish," he said, going over to the table. "I never expected to see you loafing down here in the South this time of year." "Loan me $2, Gus," Dish said. "Not me. Why would I loan money to a loafer? You ought to be trailing cattle by this time of year." "Well, I'll be leaving next week to do just that," Dish said. "Loan me $2 and I'll pay you in the fall." "Unless you get drowned or stomped or shoot somebody and get hung," Augustus said. "No, sir, too many perils ahead. Anyway, I've known you to be sly, Dish. You probably got $2 and just don't want to spend it." Lippy finished his concert and came and joined them. He wore a brown bowler hat that he had picked up on the road to San Antonio some years before. Either it had blown out of a stagecoach, or the Indians had snatched some careless drummer and not bothered to take his hat. At least those were the two theories Lippy had worked out in order to explain his good fortune in finding the hat. In Augustus's view, the hat would have looked better blown around the country for 2 years than it did at the present. Lippy only wore it when he played the piano. When he was just gambling or sitting around attending to the leak from his stomach, he frequently used the hat for an ashtray and then sometimes forgot to empty the ashes before putting the hat back on his head. He only had a few strips of stringy gray hair hanging off his skull, and the ashes didn't make them look much worse. But ashes represented only a fraction of the abuse the bowler had suffered. It was also Lippy's pillow, and had had so many things spilled on it or in it that Augustus could hardly look at it without gagging.
"That hat looks about like a buffalo cud. The hat ain't meant to be a chamber pot, you know. And if I was you, I'd just throw it away."
Lippy was so named because his lower lip was about the size of the flap on a saddlebag. He could tuck enough snuff under it to last a normal person at least a month. In general, the lip lived a life of its own there toward the bottom of his face. Even when he was just sitting quietly, studying his cards, the lip waved and wiggled as if it had a breeze blowing across it, which in fact it did. Lippy had something wrong with his nose and breathed with his mouth wide open. Accustomed as she was to hard doings, it still had taken Lorena a while to get used to the way Lippy slurped when he was eating. And she had once had a dream in which a cowboy walked by Lippy and buttoned the lip to his nose as if it were a flap of a pocket. But her disgust was nothing compared to Xavier's, who suddenly stopped wiping tables and came over and grabbed Lippy's hat off his head. Xavier was in a bad mood, and his features quivered like those of a trapped rabbit.
"Disgrace! I won't have this hat."
"Who can eat?" Xavier said, though nobody was trying to eat. He took the hat around the bar and flung it out the back door. Once as a boy, he had carried slops in a restaurant in New Orleans that actually used tablecloths, a standard of excellence which haunted him still. Every time he looked at the bare tables and the dry bean, he felt a failure. Instead of having tablecloths, the tables were so rough you could get a splinter just running your hand over them. Also, they weren't attractively round. Since the cowboys could not be prevented from whittling on their edges, over the years, sizable chunks had been whittled off, giving most of the tables an unbalanced look. He himself had a linen tablecloth which he brought out once a year on the anniversary of the death of his wife. His wife had been a bully, and he didn't miss her, but it was the only occasion sufficient to provide an excuse for the use of a tablecloth in Lonesome Dove. His wife, whose name had been Teresa, had bullied horses, too, which is why his team had run off and flung themselves and the buggy into a gully, the buggy landing right on top of Teresa. At the annual dinner in her honor, Xavier proved that he was still a restaurateur of discipline by getting drunk without spilling a drop on the fine tablecloth. Augustus was the only one invited to the dinners, but he only came every 3 or 4 years out of politeness. Not only were the occasions mournful and silly, everyone in Lonesome Dove had been glad to see the last of Teresa, they were mildly dangerous. Augustus was neither as disciplined a drinker as Xavier, nor as particular about tablecloths, and he knew that if he spilled liquor on the precious linen, the situation would end badly. He would not likely have to shoot Xavier, but it might be necessary to whack him on the head, and Augustus hated to hit such a small head with such a large pistol. To Xavier, Lippy's hat was the final exacerbation. No man of dignity would allow such a hat in his establishment, much less on the head of an employee. So from time to time he seized it and flung it out the door. Perhaps a goat would eat it. They were said to eat worse. But the goats ignored the hat. Lippy always went out to retrieve it when he remembered he needed an ashtray.
"Disgrace!" Xavier said again, in a somewhat happier tone.
Lippy was unperturbed.
"Well, what's wrong with the hat? It was made in Philadelphia.
So it says inside it." It said so, but Augustus, not Lippy, was the one who had originally made the point. Lippy could not have read a word as big as Philadelphia, and he had only the vaguest notion of where the city was. All he knew was that it must be a safe and civilized place if they had time to make hats instead of fighting Comanches.
Xavier,
I'll make you a deal, Augustus said. You loan Dish $2 so we can get a little game going, and I'll rake that hat into a tow sack and carry it home to my pigs. It's the only way you'll ever get rid of it. If you wear it again, I will burn it, Xavier said, still inflamed. I will burn the whole place. Then where will you go?
Well, if you was to burn that pianner, you best have a swift mule waiting, Lippy said, his lip undulating as he spoke.
Church folks won't like it.
Dish found the conversation a burden to listen to. He had delivered a small horse herd in Matamoros and had ridden nearly 100 miles upriver with Lori in mind. It was funny he would do it, since the thought of her scared him, but he had just kept riding, and here he was. He mainly did his sporting with Mexican whores, but now and then he found he wanted a change from small brown women. Lorena was so much of a change that at the thought of her, his throat clogged up, and he lost his ability to talk. He had already been with her 4 times and had a vivid memory of how white she was, moon pale and touched with shadows, like the night outside. Only not like the night, exactly. He could ride through the night peacefully, and a ride with Lorena was not peaceful. She used some cheap powder, a souvenir of her city living, and smell of it seemed to follow Dish for weeks. He didn't like just paying her, though. Seemed to him it would be better if he brought her a fine present from Abilene or Dodge. He could get away with that with the senoritas. They liked the idea of presents to look forward to, and Dish was careful never to renege. He always came back from Dodge with ribbons and combs. But somehow he could not get up the nerve to even make the suggestion to Lorena. It was hard enough to make a plain business offer. Often she seemed not to hear questions when they were put to her. It was hard to make a girl realize you had special feelings for her when she wouldn't look at you, didn't hear you, and made your throat clog up. It was even harder to live with the thought that the girl in question didn't want you to have the special feelings, particularly if you were about to go up the trail and not see her for many months. Confusing as these feelings were, they were made even worse for Dish by the realization that he couldn't afford even the transaction that the girl would accept. He was down to his last 2 bits, having lost a full month's wages in a game in Matamoros. He had no money and no eloquence with which to persuade Lorena to trust him, but he did have a dogged persistence that was prepared to sit in the dry bean all night and hope that his evident need would finally move her. Under the circumstances, it was a sore trial to Dish that Augustus had come in. It seemed to him that Lori had been getting a little friendlier, and if nothing had happened to distract her, he might soon have prevailed. At least it had been just him and her at the table, which had been nice in itself. But now it was him and her and Augustus and Lippy making it difficult, if not impossible, for him to plead his case. Though all he had really been doing by the way of pleading was to look at her frequently with big hopeful eyes. Lippy began to feel unhappy about the fact that Xavier had thrown his hat out the door. Augustus's mention of the pigs put the whole matter in a more ominous light. After all, the pigs might come along and eat the hat, which was one of the solidest comforts in his meager existence. He would have liked to go out and retrieve the hat before the pigs came along, but he knew that it wasn't really wise to provoke Xavier unduly when he was in a bad mood anyway. He couldn't see out the back door because the bar was in the way. For all he knew, the hat might already be gone. "I wished I could get back to St. Louis," he said. "I hear it's a right busy town." He had been reared there, and when his heart was heavy, he returned to it in his thoughts. "Why hell go? Life's a short affair. Why spend it here?" "Well, you are," Dish said in a surly tone, hoping Gus would take the hint and set out immediately.
"Dish, you sound like you've got a sour stomach," Augustus said. "What you need is a good, satisfying game of cards."
"Nothing of the kind," Dish said, casting a bold and solicitous glance at Lorena. Looking at her was like looking at the hills. The hills stayed as they were. You could go to them if you had the means, but they extended no greeting. Xavier stood at the door, staring into the dark. The rag he used to wipe the tables was dripping onto his pants leg, but he didn't notice.
"It's too bad nobody in town ain't dead," Augustus remarked. "This group has the makings of a first-rate funeral party." "What about you, Wants? Let's play cards."
Xavier acquiesced. It was better than nothing. Besides, he was a devilish good card player, one of the few around who was a consistent match for Augustus. Lorena was competent. Tankersley had taught her a little. When the dry bean was full of cowboys, she was not allowed to sit in, but on nights when the clientele consisted of Augustus, she often played. When she played, she changed, particularly if she won a little. Augustus frequently did his best to help her win a little, just to see the process take place. The child in her was briefly reborn. She didn't chatter, but she did occasionally laugh out loud, and her cloudy eyes cleared and became animated. Once in a while, when she won a really good pot, she would give Augustus a little punch with her fist. It pleased him when that happened. It was good to see the girl enjoying herself. It put him in the mind of family games, the kind he had once played with his lively sisters in Tennessee. The memory of those games usually put him to drinking more than he'd like to, and all because Lori ceased being a sulky whore for a little while and reminded him of happy girls he had once known. They played until the Rustler's Moon had crossed to the other side of town. Lorena brightened so much that Dish Bogut fell worse in love with her than ever. She filled him with such an ache that he didn't mind Xavier won half of his next month's wages. The ache was very much with him when he finally decided there was no hope and stepped out into the moonlight to unhitch his horse. Augustus had come with him, while Lippy sneaked out the back door to retrieve his hat. The light in Lorena's room came on while they were standing there, and Dish looked up at it, catching her shadow as she passed in front of the lamp.
"Well, Dish, so you're leaving us. Which outfit's lucky enough to have you this trip?"
The quick glimpse of Lorena put Dish in such perplexity of spirit that he could hardly focus on the question. "Well, reckon I'm going up with the double U's," he said, his eyes still on the window. The cause of Dish's melancholy was not lost on Augustus.
"Well, that's Shanghai Pierce's bunch," he said.
"Yep," Dish said, starting to lift his foot into the stirrup.
"Now, hold on a minute, Dish," Augustus said.
He fished in his pocket and came out with $2, which he handed to the surprised cowboy.
"If you're riding north with old Shang, we may never meet again on this side of the burn," Augustus said, deliberately adopting an alleged tone. "At the very least, you'll get your hearing ruined. That voice of his could deafen a rock." Dish had to smile.
Gus seemed unaware that one of the more persistent topics of dispute on the Texas range was whether his voice was louder than Shanghai Pierce's. It was commonly agreed that the two men had no close rivals when it came to being deafening. "Why'd you give me this money?" Dish asked. He had never been able to figure Gus out.
"You asked me for it, didn't you? If I'd have given it to you before the game started, I might as well have handed it to Wants. And he don't need no $2 of mine."
There was a pause while Dish tried to puzzle out the real motive, if there was one.
"I'd not want it thought I'd refuse a simple loan to a friend, especially not one who's going off with Shanghai Pierce."
"Oh, Mr. Pierce don't go with us," Dish said. "He goes over to New Orleans and takes the train." Augustus said nothing, and Dish soon concluded that he was to get the loan, even if the aggravation of Mr. Pierce's company wasn't involved.
"Well, much obliged then," Dish said. "I'll see you in the fall, if not sooner." "Ah, there's no need for you to ride off tonight. You could throw your blanket down on our porch if you like."
"I might do that," Dish said, feeling rather awkward. He rehitched his horse and went to the door of the dry bean, wanting to get upstairs before Lori turned off her light. "I believe I left something," he said lamely at the door of the saloon.
"Well, I won't wait, Dish. We'll expect you for breakfast if you care to stay."
As he strolled away, he heard the boy's footsteps hitting the stairs at the back of the saloon. Dish was a good boy, not much less green than Newt, though a more experienced hand.
Best to help such boys have their moment of fun before life's torment snatched them. From a distance, standing in the pale street, he saw two shadows against the yellow box of light from Laurie's room. She wasn't that set against Dish, it seemed to him, and she had been pepped up from all the card playing. Maybe even Laurie would be surprised and find a liking for the boy. Occasionally he had known sporting women to marry and do well at it. If Laurie were so inclined, Dish Boguette would not be a bad man to settle on. The light had gone off at the Pumphreys, and Armadillo was no longer there to roll its shadow at him. Pigs were all stretched out on the porch, lying practically snout to snout. Augustus was about to kick them off to make room for the guest he more or less expected, but they looked so peaceful he relented and went around to the back door. If Dish Boguette, with his prairie dog of a mustache, considered himself too refined to throw his bedroll beside two fine pigs, then he could root him out himself.
Chapter 5.
Whatever subject Augustus had on his mind when he went to bed was generally still sitting there when he woke up. He was such a short sleeper that the subject had no time to slip out of his mind. 5 hours was as much as he ever slept at a stretch. 4 hours was more nearly as average. "A man that sleeps all night wastes too much of life," he often said. "As I see it, the days was made for looking, and the nights for sport." Since sport was what he had been brooding about when he got home, it was still in his thoughts when he arose, which he did about 4 a.m., to see to the breakfast. In his view, too important a meal to entrust to the Mexican bandit. The heart of his breakfast was a plentitude of sourdough biscuits, which he cooked in a Dutch oven out in the backyard. His pot dough had been perking along happily for over 10 years, and the first thing he did upon rising was check it out. The rest of the breakfast was secondary, just a matter of whacking off a few slabs of bacon and frying a pan full of pullet eggs. Bolivar could generally be trusted to deal with a coffee. Augustus cooked his biscuits outside for 3 reasons. One was because the house was sure to heat up well enough anyway during the day, so there was no point in building any more of a fire than was necessary for bacon and eggs. 2 was because biscuits cooked in a Dutch oven tasted better than stove-cooked biscuits. And 3 was because he liked to be outside to catch the first light. A man that depended on an indoor cook stove would miss the sunrise, and if he missed the sunrise in Lonesome Dove, he would have to wait out a long stretch of heat and dust before he got to see anything so pretty. Augustus molded his biscuits and went out and got a fire going in the Dutch oven while it was still good and dark, just enough of a fire to freshen up his bed of mesquite coals. When he judged the oven was ready, he brought the biscuits and his Bible out in the backyard. He set the biscuits in the oven and sat down on a big black kettle that they used on rare occasions when they rendered lard. The kettle was big enough to hold a small mule if anybody wanted to boil one, but for the last few years it had remained upside down, making an ideal seat. The eastern sky was red as coals in a forge, lighting up the flats along the river. Dew had wet the million needles of the chaparral, and when the rim of the sun edged over the horizon, the chaparral seemed to be spotted with diamonds. A bush in the backyard was filled with little rainbows as the sun touched the dew. It was tribute enough to sunup that it could make even chaparral bushes look beautiful, Augustus thought. And he watched the process happily, knowing it would only last a few minutes. The sun spread reddish-gold light through the shining bushes, among which a few goats wandered, bleating. Even when the sun rose above the low bluffs to the south, a layer of light lingered for a bit at the level of the chaparral, as if independent of its source. Then the sun lifted clear, like an immense coin. The dew quickly dried, and the light that filled the bushes like red dust dispersed, leaving clear, slightly bluish air. It was good reading light by then, so Augustus applied himself for a few minutes to the prophets. He was not exactly overly religious, but he did consider himself a fair prophet and liked to study the styles of his predecessors. They were mostly too long-winded in his view, and he made no effort to read them verse for verse. He just had a look here and there while the biscuits were browning. While he was enjoying a verse or two of Amos, the pigs walked around the corner of the house, and Call, at almost the same moment, stepped out the back door, pulling on his shirt. The pigs walked over and stood directly in front of Augustus. The dew had wet their blue coats.
"They know I got a soft heart," he said to Call. "They're hoping I'm going to feed them this Bible. I hope you pigs didn't wake up Dish," he added.
For he had checked and seen that Dish was there, sleeping comfortably with his head on his saddle and his hat over his eyes, only the big mustache showing. To Call's regret, he had never been able to come awake easily. His joints felt like they were filled with glue, and it was an irritation to see Augustus sitting on the black kettle looking as fresh as if he'd slept all night, when in fact he had probably played poker until 1 or 2 o'clock. Getting up early and feeling awake was the one skill he had never truly perfected. He got up, of course, but it never felt natural. Augustus laid down the Bible and walked over to look at Call's wound.
"You ought to slop some more axle grease on it. That's a nasty bite."
"You tend to the biscuits," Call said. "What's Dish Boget doing here?"
"I didn't ask the man his business. If you die of gangrene, you'll be sorry you didn't let me dress that wound."
"Well, it ain't a wound. It's just a bite. I was bit worse by bedbugs down in Saltillo that time."
"I suppose you set up reading the good book all night." "Not me. I only read it in the morning and the evening, when I can be reminded of the glory of the Lord. The rest of the day, I'm just reminded of what a miserable stinkhole we stuck ourselves in. It's hard to have fun in a place like this, but I do my best."
He went over and put his hand on the top of the Dutch oven. It felt to him like the biscuits were probably ready, so he took them out. They had puffed up nicely and were healthy and brown. He took them quickly into the house, and Call followed. Newt was at the table, sitting straight upright, with a knife in one hand and a fork in the other, but sound asleep.
"We come to this place to make money," Call said. "Nothing about fun was in the deal." "Call, you don't even like money. You spit in the eye of every rich man you ever met. You like money even less than you like fun, if that's possible."
Call sighed and sat down at the table. Bolivar was up, stumbling around the stove, shaking so that he spilled coffee grounds on the floor.
"Wake up, Newt. If you don't, you'll fall over and stick yourself in the eye with your own fork."
Call gave the boy a little shake, and his eyes popped open.
"I was having a dream," Newt said, sounding very young. "You're tough luck, then, son. Morning around here is more like a nightmare. Now look what's happened."
In an effort to get the coffee going, Bolivar had spilled a small pile of coffee grounds into the grease where the eggs and bacon were frying. It seemed a small enough matter to him, but it enraged Augustus, who liked to achieve an orderly breakfast at least once a week.
"I guess it won't hurt the coffee none to taste like eggs. Most of the time your eggs taste like coffee."
"I don't care," Bolivar said. "I feel sick." P.I. came stumbling through about that time, trying to get his pizzle out of his pants before his bladder started to flood. It was a frequent problem. The pants he wore had about 15 small buttons, and he got up each morning and buttoned every one of them before he realized he was about to piss. And then he would come rushing through the kitchen trying to undo the buttons. The race was always close, but usually P. would make it to the back steps before the flood commenced. Then he would stand there and splatter the yard for 5 minutes or so. When he could hear sizzling grease in one ear and the sound of P.I. pissing in the other, Augustus knew that the peace of the morning was over once again.
"If a woman ever stumbled into this outfit at this hour of the day, she'd screech and poke out her eyes," Augustus said.
At that point, someone did stumble onto it, but only Dish Boget, who had always been responsive to the smell of frying bacon. It was a surprise to Newt, who immediately snapped awake and tried to get his cowlick to lay down. Dish Boget was one of his heroes, a real cowboy who had been up the trail all the way to Dodge City more than once. It was Newt's great ambition to go up the trail with a herd of cattle. The sight of Dish gave him hope. Perdish wasn't somebody totally out of reach like the captain. Newt didn't imagine that he could ever be what the captain was, but Dish seemed not that much different from himself. He was known to be a top hand. Newt welcomed every chance to be around him. He liked to study the way Dish did things. "Morning, Dish," he said. "Why, howdy there," Dish said, and went to stand beside P.I. and attend to the same business. It perked Newt up that Dish didn't treat him like a kid. Someday, if he was lucky, maybe he and Dish would be cowboys together. Newt could imagine nothing better. Augustus had fried the eggs hard as marbles to compensate for the coffee grains, and when they looked done to him, he poured the grease into a big 3-gallon syrup can they used for a grease bucket. "It's poor table manners to piss in hearing of those at the table," he said, directing his remark to the gentleman on the porch. "You two are grown men. Now what would your mothers think?" Dish looked a little sheepish, whereas P was merely confused by the question. His mother had passed away in Georgia when he was only 6. She had not had the time to give him much training before she died, and he had no idea what she might think of such an action. However, he was sure that she would not have wanted him to go in his pants. "Well, I had to hurry," he said. "Howdy, Captain," Dish said. Call nodded. In the morning, he had the advantage of Gus, since Gus had to cook. With Gus cooking, he had got his choice of the eggs and bacon, and a little food always brought him to life and made him consider all the things that ought to be done during the day. The Hat Creek outfit was just a small operation with just enough land under lease to graze small lots of cattle and horses until the buyers could be found. It amazed Call that such a small operation could keep 3 grown men and a boy occupied from sun up until dark, day after day, but such was the case. The barn and corrals had been in such poor shape when he and Gus bought the place that it took constant work just to keep them from total collapse. There was nothing important to do in Lonesome Dove, but that didn't mean there was enough time to keep up with the little things that needed doing. They had been 6 weeks sinking in a new well and were still far from deep enough. When Call raked the eggs and bacon onto his plate, such a crowd of possible tasks rushed into his mind that he was a minute responding to Dish's greeting. "Oh, hello, Dish," he said finally. "Have some bacon."
"Dish is planning to shave his mustache right after breakfast," Augustus said. "He's getting tired of living without women."
In fact, with the aid of Gus's $2, Dish had been able to prevail on Lorena. He had awakened on the porch with a clear head, but when Augustus mentioned women, he remembered it all and suddenly felt weak with love. He had been keenly hungry when he sat down at the table, his mouth watering for eggs and fryback, but the thought of Lorena's white body, or portion of it that he had got to see when she lifted her nightgown, made him almost dizzy for a moment. He continued to eat, but the food had lost its taste. The blue shote came to the door and looked in at the people, to Augustus's amusement.
"Now look at that! A pig watching a bunch of human pigs!"
Though he had been out-positioned at the frying pan, he was in prime shape to secure his share of the biscuits, half a dozen of which he had already sopped in honey and consumed.
"Throw that pig them eggshells," he said to Bolivar. "He's starving."
"I don't care," Bolivar said, sucking coffee-colored sugar out of a big spoon. "I feel sick."
"You're repeating yourself, Bol. You're planning on dying today. I hope you dig your grave first."
Bolivar looked at him sorrowfully. So much talk in the morning gave him a headache to go with his shakes. "If I dig a grave, it will be yours," he said simply. "Going up the trail, Dish?" Newt asked, hoping to turn the conversation to more cheerful matters.
"I hope to," Dish said.
"It would take a hacksaw to cut these eggs," Call said. "I've seen bricks that was softer." "Well, Bol spilled coffee in 'em," Augustus said. "I expect it was hard coffee."
Call finished the rock-like eggs and gave Dish the once-over. He was a lank fellow, loose-built and a good rider. 5 or 6 more of him, and they could make up a herd themselves and drive it north. The idea had been in his mind for a year or more. He had even mentioned it to Augustus, but Augustus merely laughed at him.
"We're too old, Carl," he said. "We forgot everything we need to know."
"You may have," Carl said. "I ain't." Seeing Dish put Carl in mind of his idea again. He was not eager to spend the rest of his life on well digging or barn repair. They made up a fair herd and did well with it. They would make enough to buy some good land north of the brush country.
"Are you signed on with someone then?" he asked Dish.
"Oh, no, I ain't signed on," Dish said. "But I've gone before. I imagine Mr. Pierce will hire me again. Or if not him, someone else."
"Well, we might give you work right here," Carl said.
That got Augustus's attention.
"Give him